You're listening to a podcast from Cancer.net. This cancer information website is produced by the American Society of Clinical Oncology, known as ASCO, the world's leading professional organization for doctors who care for people with cancer. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform. This is not a substitute for professional medical care and is not intended for use in the diagnosis or treatment of individual conditions. Guests on this podcast express their own opinions, experience, and conclusions. The mention of any product, service, organization, activity, or therapy should not be construed as an ASCO endorsement. Cancer research discussed in this podcast is ongoing, so the data described here may change as research progresses. In the Research Roundup series, members of the Cancer.net editorial board discuss the most exciting and practice-changing research in their field and explain what it means for people with cancer. In today's podcast, four Cancer.net specialty editors discuss new research in prostate, bladder, kidney, and testicular cancers presented at the 2021 Genitourinary Cancer Symposium and 2021 ASCO Annual Meeting. This episode has been adapted from the recording of a live Cancer.net webinar held June 16, 2021, and led by Dr. Neeraj Agarwal, Dr. Tian Zhang, Dr. Petros Grivas, and Dr. Timothy Gilligan. Dr. Agarwal directs the Genitourinary Oncology Program at the Huntsman Cancer Institute at the University of Utah. Dr. Grivas is the Clinical Director of the Genitourinary Cancers Program at University of Washington Medicine. He is also an associate member of the Clinical Research Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Zhang is an associate professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine and is a medical oncologist at Duke Cancer Institute. Dr. Gilligan is an associate professor and medical oncologist at the Cleveland Clinic Taussig Cancer Institute. Full disclosures for Dr. Agarwal, Dr. Grivas, Dr. Zhang, and Dr. Gilligan are available at cancer.net.
So today, let's introduce our participants. First, we have Dr. Neeraj Agarwal of Huntsman Cancer Institute and University of Utah and the Cancer.net specialty editor for prostate cancer. Next, we have Dr. Petros Grivas from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and University of Washington. He is the specialty editor for Cancer.net for bladder cancer. Next, we have Dr. Tian Zhang of Duke Cancer Institute, and she's our Cancer.net specialty editor for kidney cancer. And last, we have Dr. Timothy Gilligan. He's with the Cleveland Clinic Taussig Cancer Institute and the specialty editor for testicular cancer. And so starting off, we'll have Dr. Agarwal talking about prostate cancer.
Thank you, Greg. It's such a privilege and honor to be here discussing these studies. So I would like to start with the first study, which was led by Dr. Steve Friedland, who is a urologist at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, and was co-authored by me, Dr. Dan George, and many others. And here in this study, we present the utilization of therapies which are associated or known to be associated with very significant, in fact, I would say dramatic improvement in overall survival, as shown by multiple randomized control trials over the period of last 5 to 6 years. Just to take a step back for the audience, until 2014, standard treatment for metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer or newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer used to be androgen deprivation therapy. And combining androgen deprivation therapy with those medications which were approved in castration-resistant metastatic prostate cancer setting, so basically using those drugs upfront led to dramatic improvement in overall survival with 33 to 35% reduction in risk of death across these clinical trials. So we actually wanted to look at the real-world utilization, so look at the real-world uses of these medications in these patients who are being diagnosed with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer in the United States. We also wanted to see how patients who belong to minority population or racial minority populations, how they are being treated with these medications, which are backed by level one evidence. So this was a retrospective analysis of a Medicare database More than 35,000 patients were included from 2009 to 2018. And we can see here very representative patient population, predominantly white patients, 11.8% were African American and 5% were Hispanic. And here are the results. From 2010 to 2014, the use of standard androgen deprivation therapy or standard androgen deprivation therapy with bicalutamide, which is also considered standard deprivation therapy, was used in 97% patients. Not surprising, we did not have any of these trials reporting by then. Let's go to 2015 to 2016. Docetaxel was already approved in this setting now. And we can see some patients received docetaxel, but a small minority of patients received docetaxel. And then let's move to 2018, which is 4 or 5 years after docetaxel data had been presented by Dr. Sweeney in the ASCO plenary session. And abiraterone was approved in 2017. And we are still seeing, even like almost 2 years after, we are still seeing vast majority of patients being treated with standard androgen deprivation therapy or standard androgen deprivation therapy with bicalutamide. So 62% plus 19%, we are talking about almost 80% patients still not being treated with standard of care treatment, which is androgen deprivation therapy plus docetaxel or androgen deprivation therapy plus abiraterone at that point of time. And now we have two more drugs available, which include enzalutamide and apalutamide in this setting. So another interesting thing was, if you look at the patients who belong to minority populations, so let's look at African-American patients compared to Caucasian patients, the use of intensified therapy was numerically lower. So in Caucasian patients, we are seeing higher use of intensified, as we call them, intensified therapy or therapy which are considered standard of care compared to African-American men. So overall, the usage was lower across the board, but if you look at African-American men, the usage was even lower. So this is definitely concerning. I call it alarming underutilization of life-prolonging therapy in patients who are being diagnosed with new diagnosis of metastatic prostate cancer. And we definitely can improve this. We can definitely offer better care to our patients. It is not acceptable, in my view, to have 30% or less patients receiving standard of care therapies. So with that, I'll go to the next study.
Great, thanks. And this study is health-related quality of life and patient-reported outcomes at final analysis of the TITAN study of apalutamide versus placebo in patients with metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer receiving androgen deprivation therapy. And you were the presenting author of this, Dr. Agarwal.
Yes, Greg, thank you for giving the opportunity to present this study. And this is basically the continuation of the previous trial. I will not delve into in-depth analysis of these data. I just wanted to show that quality of life is not being impacted adversely by using intensified androgen deprivation therapy. So if you are using these drugs, which improve survival in a very significant fashion, and they are not being used in our patients, as we just saw in the previous study, what could be the reason? Is it the concerns about quality of life or adverse impact on quality of life? If that is the concern, this study, I think, helps refute those concerns. And in this study, which was a large study known as TITAN trial, which led to approval of apalutamide for patients with hormone-sensitive or castration-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer, and showed improved survival, radiographic progression-free survival, and overall survival, we also looked at quality of life data in these patients, as reported by these patients. And these quality of life data were assessed by very standardized validated scales known as FACT-P, or Functional Assessment of Cancer Therapy Prostate Scale, or Brief Pain Inventory Tool. And there are many other tools. So I will show you the results. And we can see here consistently there was no difference in quality of life as reported by the patients, or I would say any adverse impact on quality of life of these patients in any of these questions as they were taking these questionnaires. So whether it was physical well-being, emotional well-being, functional well-being, social or family well-being, and also we looked at fatigue, and there was no adverse impact on quality of life. So at least Great. From this perspective, we should not be concerned about using these drugs upfront in our patients who have newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer.
Great. And so what does this mean for patients?
From patient perspective, we can see here very clearly that using standardized tools, very validated tools, which have been used in multiple trials in the past, patients are not reporting any adverse impact on their quality of life when being treated with intensified androgen deprivation therapy, in this context, apalutamide.
All right, so let's move on to our next study, which is a phase 3 study of lutetium-177, PSMA-617, in patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, the VISION trial.
Thank you. In my view, this is one of the most important studies presented in the 2021 ASCO annual meeting. This study was a phase 3 study where 700 patients were recruited, and these patients had metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, and they had disease progression on a prior novel hormonal therapy such as enzalutamide or abiraterone, and patients had received a taxane chemotherapy as well. So at least one taxane chemotherapy was required before enrollment on the trial, and patients had to have disease progression on a novel hormonal therapy. These patients were randomized in 2-to-1 fashion to a novel drug, which is a type of radiation, intravenous radiation, as I would explain to my patients. And this is known as beta radiation. And this is a novel radioligand therapy where a radiation particle, which is delivering beta radiation particle to the cancer cells, is tagged to a molecule which binds with the prostate cancer cells. So I'm simplifying it for the sake of our patients. And this particle or this compound was added to standard of care therapy, and patients were randomized to standard of care therapy versus standard of care therapy plus this new compound. And standard of care therapy was a novel hormonal therapy or anything which did not include chemotherapy or radium-223, which is another type of radiation particle, but a different kind of radiation particle known as alpha particle. So in this study, radiographic progression-free survival and overall survival were primary endpoints. So we can see here that the study met both primary endpoints. There was a significant improvement in radiographic progression-free survival with a almost 5.4 months to be precise, improvement in radiographic progression-free survival with a 60% reduction in risk of disease progression or death. If you look at overall survival, it was also improved in a significant fashion in patients who received the new compound known as lutetium PSMA-617. The median overall survival was improved by 4 months with a approximately 40% reduction in risk of death. This was a well-tolerated drug overall. And if you look at high-grade side effects, treatment emergent side effects, there were 52.7% of patients in the experimental arm and 38% patients in the control arm had those treatment-related side effects. So overall, well-tolerated regimen with improved overall survival and radiographic progression-free survival. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Agarwal. This is really interesting, and it'll be interesting to see if this treatment does change standard of care based on this research. Let's move on to Dr. Grievous and bladder cancer research. Dr. Grievous, your first study is avelumab first-line maintenance for urothelial carcinoma, analysis of clinical and genomic subgroups from the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial. And Dr. Grievous was a co-principal investigator of this trial and the senior author of the New England Journal of Medicine publication and co-author of this abstract. Go ahead, Dr. Grievous.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thank to the cancer.net for the opportunity, and thanks to the audience. We welcome questions. I would like to update the audience today about the dates we saw at the ASCO virtual meeting. I would also like to place this data in context. So I would remind the audience that the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial changed clinical practice, was initially presented last year at the ASCO virtual meeting 2020 by Professor Pauls. And this particular trial tried to answer the following question. Does the immunotherapy, especially the PD-L1 inhibitor avelumab, add value in patients who completed chemotherapy in the first-line setting of metastatic urothelial cancer compared to just best supportive care in terms of longer life, overall survival, as well as time until the cancer grows or death, progression-free survival? And this is important because until the study came about last year, the practice was in the setting of spread metastatic urothelial cancer, when we start treating patients with chemotherapy in this, what we call first-line setting, the initial approach, when the chemotherapy stops because we cannot give it for a long time because of potential side effects, usually you used to wait until the cancer grows back, the cancer, what we call progresses or grows. So this trial compared this approach, the observation or best supportive care alone, versus the immunotherapy with avelumab, anti-PD-L1, plus the best supportive care. And this particular trial showed a significant improvement in life expectancy, overall survival, as well as in progression-free survival, time until progression of the cancer or death, in patients who receive this anti-PD-L1 immune checkpoint inhibitor, this immunotherapy drug avelumab, as a way to maintain or sustain the benefit achieved with chemotherapy. So we call this a maintenance therapy approach because we try to maintain or sustain the benefit with chemotherapy. I want to highlight that this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the audience can retrieve that from PubMed if someone wants to read the manuscript. The bottom line is that this trial changed practice, and we can go now to the updates we saw in this particular meeting, ASCO 2021. I think the main question was, are there any particular subsets of patients, different categories of patients who benefit more from the avelumab maintenance approach, or this applies to all the patients? And we saw here in the abstract, we saw that ASCO meeting, we saw that the benefit with this immunotherapy appears consistent across the board, across different subcategories of groups of patients. And I think it's important to point out that we looked at patients who had what we call local disease around the bladder that was invading this area, and the pelvic sidewall that was not amenable to surgical resection, and also patients with spread of the cancer in distant sites, what we call metastasis. We also look at, you know, at patients who had a primary origin of the cancer in the bladder or higher up in the urinary tract, what we call kidney pelvis or ureter, and we call this upper urinary tract versus the lower urinary tract, which is the bladder. And we also looked at patients who had cancer metastasis that was spread in the lymph nodes only or other parts of the body. And the bottom line is that we saw that this benefit with immunotherapy was consistent across the different groups of patients. So many patients benefit from this treatment, again, with variable degrees, variable magnitudes of benefit. But overall, the take-home message to the bottom line is, if you look at different clinical factors or other molecular factors, we do not have a reliable, accurate tool to select which patients should go with avelumab. So we offer it now nowadays in every patient who has no contraindication to get immunotherapy and has achieved some disease control, meaning a response shrinkage of the cancer or stabilization of the cancer with the chemotherapy phase. So that has real clinical implications, and I encourage the audience to discuss with their oncologist about the optimal role of immunotherapy in this maintenance setting after chemotherapy, assuming disease control with chemotherapy. Just for context here, I want to highlight the options that the patients have in clinical practice. And when someone is diagnosed with spread urothelial cancer, bladder cancer, or upper urinary tract urothelial cancer, the options include chemotherapy that we just discussed, and those who have shrinkage of the cancer or stabilization of the cancer, they can be offered nowadays avelumab as a maintenance strategy to maintain the benefit with chemotherapy. The other options include immunotherapy upfront, like drugs like pembrolizumab or atezolizumab. And I will come back to that question, how to select your treatment, in my last slide. But I want to point out that these are the options. And obviously, clinical trials are always a great option for patients, and they should ask their oncologists about those options. So since I talked about chemotherapy, I just want to point out that the ideal chemotherapy is cisplatin-based chemotherapy with a drug called cisplatin. Not everybody has enough fitness of the body to tolerate cisplatin. For those patients who can, we think cisplatin may be too much, we use carboplatin, gemcitabine, and then we can do avelumab maintenance in either scenario. But what about immunotherapy after chemotherapy? Is there data supporting that use? And the answer is yes. There is some data suggesting that immunotherapy can be an option for some of the patients. In this particular slide, we update the data from another clinical trial. And I will let Greg, you can read the title of that.
Sure. So this study is a first-line pembrolizumab in cisplatin-ineligible patients with advanced urothelial cancer. Response and survival results up to 5 years from the KEYNOTE-052 phase two study. And Dr. Grievous, you are a co-author on this study.
That's right. Thank you, Greg. So this trial presented longer follow-up to see what happens in patients who receive the immune checkpoint inhibitor anti-PD-1 called pembrolizumab because they were not fit enough to get cisplatin chemotherapy. Keep in mind that this study was designed before the previous study that I showed you presented the results and included patients who were not fit for cisplatin, but some of them could have been fit for carboplatin. But there was no comparison here. Everybody received pembrolizumab as a single agent, I would say alone. And in this particular study, we try to see the degree of shrinkage of the cancer, overall response rate, as well as how people live over time. So that with longer follow-up, by the way, we published this study in Lancet Oncology, I think, a few years ago, and now we have longer follow-up. And what you see here, that the degree of shrinkage of the cancer, what we call overall response rate, was about 29% in what we call all comers, but it was higher chance of tumor shrinkage in patients with high PD-L1 expression. PD-L1 is though this break of the immune system, the checkpoint of the immune system, and the higher the expression of PD-L1 measured by a particular assay, the higher the chance of pembrolizumab to work better in those patients. However, some patients even with low PD-L1 measured by this CPS score that I put in that slide still may have benefit. So the take-home message here is that there's a particular proportion of patients who can benefit from the checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab. PD-L1 can be used in that setting to help decide between chemotherapy and immunotherapy. However, we have not compared directly the chemotherapy followed by the avelumab maintenance with immunotherapy upfront. So this question is still lingering. However, if a patient has a response, shrinkage to pembrolizumab, many of those patients may have a long-lasting response. We try now to figure out with research, how can we predict who is going to benefit more from this treatment? That's a matter of ongoing research.
And Dr. Grievous, can you really quickly define CPS for our audience?
Sure, absolutely. Great question, Greg. Thank you. So CPS is a tool we use in the pathology labs to measure the PD-L1 expression. So PD-L1 expression can be measured by different assays and antibodies. And the pathologists, they use a score to define if the PD-L1 is high or low. In this particular study, CPS, this score 10 or higher defines PD-L1 high expression. CPS below 10 defines PD-L1 low expression. And this CPS score measuring PD-L1 expression appears to have some association with the chance of the tumor shrinking with the immunotherapy with pembrolizumab.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Grievous. And so our last study is pembrolizumab versus investigator's choice of paclitaxel, docetaxel, or VINFLUNINE in recurrent advanced urothelial cancer, 5-year follow-up from the phase 3 KEYNOTE-045 trial.
Very quickly, this study compared immunotherapy pembrolizumab, an anti-PD-1 agent, compared to chemotherapy with drugs like paclitaxel or docetaxel or VINFLUNINE, the latter one is in Europe, after progression cancer growth on platinum-based chemotherapy. So this study was published in New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. And the bottom line was that pembrolizumab prolonged overall survival. People live longer compared to this salvage, as we call it, chemotherapy. And this longer follow-up that was presented by Dr. Bellmoon and colleagues in this meeting showed the sustained results with longer follow-up. Again, this population of patients had already received platinum-based chemotherapy, cisplatin or carboplatin, the cancer progressed, grew despite that chemo. And in those patients, pembrolizumab appears to produce better results compared to this salvage chemotherapy as shown in that particular slide. And this has implications because immunotherapy can be used in those patients after progression in platinum-based chemotherapy. And just to wrap up here the discussion, I just want to give the options to the patients. If someone has a new urothelial cancer, the options include cisplatin, gemcitabine, or if someone is not fit enough for cisplatin, can get carboplatin, gemcitabine. And both of those scenarios can be followed by avelumab as switch maintenance immunotherapy in those with response shrinkage or stable disease. Patients who had progression on platinum-based chemotherapy, they can get pembrolizumab. Of course, there are other options available. We can go in detail in another podcast, but I encourage the audience to look and discuss with the oncologist about those options. And if take home message is clinical trials is what got us here. And I always recommend clinical trials to be discussed with the oncologist. Thank you so much. And I will be happy to take questions.
Thanks, Dr. Grievous. So we're going to move on to Dr. Zhang, who's going to talk about kidney cancer. So our first study today is pembrolizumab versus placebo as post-nephrectomy adjuvant therapy for patients with renal cell carcinoma, a randomized double-blind phase 3 KEYNOTE-564 study.
Thanks, Greg. I'm really excited to be here today, and thanks everyone for joining. KEYNOTE-564 was presented at the ASCO plenary by our colleague, Dr. Schweri, and his colleagues. You know, this was a highly anticipated study in the adjuvant space for kidney cancer. It enrolled patients with high-risk clear cell kidney cancer who had undergone either nephrectomy or a metastasectomy, removing their few sites of metastatic disease, and treating those patients with either pembrolizumab for up to a year or placebo. And the primary endpoint was disease-free survival. And enough events had occurred by this ASCO for us to see the primary results. So the study was positive for the primary endpoint. Disease-free survival improvement was met with a hazard ratio of 0.68. And the estimated disease-free survival rate at 2 years was 77% for patients treated with pembrolizumab versus 68% for patients treated with placebo. The overall survival favored pembrolizumab, but it was not yet statistically significant, and more follow-up will be needed. So overall, we do see an improvement of disease-free survival, delaying time until recurrence for patients treated with pembrolizumab. And this was the first study in this adjuvant space showing checkpoint inhibition has a role in adjuvant treatment of renal cell carcinoma.
All right, thanks, Dr. Zhang. Our next study is pembrolizumab plus axitinib versus sunitinib as first-line therapy for advanced clear cell renal cell carcinoma, results from 42-month follow-up of KEYNOTE-426.
Great. Thanks, Greg. You know, this study, KEYNOTE-426, we are all very familiar with. Axitinib and pembrolizumab has been used now for the last 2 years in first-line treatment of metastatic clear cell kidney cancer. So it was purely a longer-term follow-up, more events, and more understanding of what happens to these patients as they're treated in the longer term. So primary endpoints, of course, of this phase 3 study were progression-free survival and overall survival. When we're looking at this medium duration of follow-up at 42 months, so about 3.5 years, pembro and axitinib improved both median overall survival as well as median progression-free survival. Would point out that at the 3.5 year mark, the overall survival rate for patients treated with the combination was about 57.5%, and the progression-free survival rate was about 25%. So about a quarter of patients had not had progression of disease at 3.5 years, which is quite meaningful if they can stay on their first-line treatment for that long. The objective responses was 60%, and of note, the complete response rate had been updated to about 10%. So there are some patients that do have delayed complete responses, and no new safety signals were observed. So overall, certainly still provides a lot of evidence to treat with pembrolizumab and axitinib for patients in the frontline setting.
Great. And our last study here is health-related quality of life analysis from the phase 3 CLEAR trial of lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab or everolimus versus sunitinib for patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma.
So this was the phase 3 trial in first-line treatment of metastatic clear cell kidney cancer that was reported at GU ASCO in February of 2020. And it was a 3-arm randomization to lenvatinib with everolimus, which is very standard in the refractory setting, lenvatinib with pembrolizumab or sunitinib alone. And so we saw the efficacy data in February, and here we're seeing the quality of life outcomes and looking at how patients are doing patient-reported outcomes on these treatments. And so with multiple quality of life measures, we're seeing improvements in patients that had better disease-related scores of symptoms when treated with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab versus sunitinib. We're seeing pain scores improve and patients having less diarrhea or appetite loss when we're comparing against sunitinib. Of note, it's hard to specifically tie a particular symptom if that's improved because they've had better disease control or if it's more from the treatment side effect itself. So still hard to tease out a causality in these quality of life measures, but overall improvement in patients' quality of life when treated with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, and certainly provide some more data for patients receiving this combination. And so I just wanted to highlight our ongoing phase 3 combination trials in first-line metastatic kidney cancer. PIVOT-09 with bempegaldesleukin has completed accrual in the first triplet of COSMIC-313 with ipilimumab, nivolumab, and cabozantinib has also completed accrual. So the actively enrolling studies currently are Pedigree and Probe. These are studies that are being carried out in the cooperative groups, as well as a triplet belzutifan lenvatinib with pembrolizumab, a study that Merck is running. So certainly all three very important studies that we will continue to learn from and answer some important clinically relevant sequencing, treatment discontinuation, cytoreductive nephrectomy types of questions. Thanks to everybody.
We have one more. So clinical activity of durvalumab and savolitinib in MET-driven metastatic papillary renal cancer.
Dr. Rodriguez from Spain presented this of papillary renal cell carcinoma treated with savolitinib and durvalumab, and specifically looked at the MET-driven subset of 14 patients out of these 42 patients. The efficacy primary endpoint was objective response rate. And of note, in median progression-free survival for the 42 patients who were all treated was 4.9 months, but in MET-driven disease, so savolitinib targets MET, and so in MET-driven disease, it was 10.5 months. The median overall survival for everyone was 14 months versus MET-driven was 27 months, and also higher response rates for patients with MET-driven disease. So I think certainly hypothesis generating, we will likely be seeing more trials with durvalumab and savolitinib in MET-driven papillary renal cell carcinoma. Thanks.
Thank you again, Dr. Zhang. And Dr. Gilligan, we're going to talk about some testicular cancer research now. And the first study is testicular cancer in the cisplatin era, causes of death and mortality rates in a population-based cohort.
So this study was looking at what happens to men with testicular cancer who are cured of their cancer. Are they at risk of dying of other causes? They looked at over 5,000 men treated between 1980 and 2009. So it's important to recognize that some of the treatments given back then are a little different than where they're given now. And they looked at the risk of death from causes other than testis cancer in these men compared to men without testicular cancer in the general population. And the concerning finding from this study, and it's not the first study to report this, was that the risk of non-testicular cancer death, that is death from other causes, was increased by about 28% in men who'd been treated with radiation therapy and about 23% in men treated with chemotherapy. There's a risk of non-testicular cancer death. The risk was doubled in those whose treatment included both. So it was higher with either radiation or chemo, but it was 100% higher or doubled in those who had both chemotherapy and radiation. as you got more chemotherapy, the risk went up. There was no trend towards the increase with just one or two cycles. We started to see the increase with three cycles, and it became statistically significant with four cycles. But there wasn't much difference between three and four in terms of the absolute number that was seen. In terms of death from other cancers, so why is this happening? Other cancers are a major issue after chemotherapy or radiation. Again, the risk was increased by about 60% after radiation therapy and 43% after chemotherapy. In those who got both, the risk of cancer was actually three times higher than the general population. So that's in men who had both chemotherapy plus radiation therapy. Fortunately, there are not a lot of men who get both of those treatments anymore. Non-cancer deaths increased 17% after radiation and 23% after chemo, and 55% of treatment included both. So the risk for non-cancer deaths was not as high as the risk for death from secondary malignancies. Interestingly, the risk of suicide increased 63% in men treated with chemotherapy. That's not affecting as many men as those other numbers, even though the 63% number looks high, but it is a concern. Those treated only with surgery did not have an increased risk of non-testicular cancer death. So what does this mean for patients? It really means that when we can use surgical treatments instead of chemotherapy or radiation, there's an additional incentive to try to do that. And what that may mean is that there should be a larger role for retroperitoneal lymph node dissection as an alternative to chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Secondly, for patients who are getting chemotherapy, it's a real argument to minimize the number of cycles of chemo, as long as we're not sacrificing long-term cure rates, because the biggest risk of death is dying from the cancer. But that means limiting it to three cycles instead of four cycles is probably a good idea. And I think it's an argument to use three cycles of BEP instead of four cycles of EP, because it's really the etoposide and the platinum that's linked to the secondary cancer risk, not the bleomycin as far as we know. And then lastly, we need to pay attention to the mental health needs of men treated with chemotherapy, that there is more emotional distress, and we're seeing here a higher risk of suicide.
Great. And so our second trial is the SEMS trial, result of a prospective multi-institutional phase 2 clinical trial of surgery in early metastatic seminoma.
So if we're going to use more retroperitoneal lymph node dissection and less chemotherapy or radiation, one place to do that is in stage 1 and stage 2 seminoma. And many centers around the country have started doing that, and this was a trial that looked at that approach. So these are men who normally would be treated with chemotherapy, three cycles of BEP, or radiation therapy to the back of the abdomen and part of the pelvis potentially. This study looked at a small number of patients, 55 men. They had low volume stage 2 seminoma, up to 3 centimeters in size and maximum dimension. And what they reported was that of those men, they undergoing retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, 10 relapsed, so 18% relapsed after median follow-up of 24 months. They were all alive at the end of the study. There were no deaths. 8 of 10 relapses were treated with chemotherapy, but 2 were treated with additional chemotherapy. So out of the 55 men, 8 ended up getting chemotherapy. Normally, all of them would have gotten either chemo or radiation. Relapse-free survival was 87%, and overall survival was 100%. So 7 patients developed complications after RPLND, and 5 of them were mild, 2 of them were more severe. So it's a well-tolerated treatment. If it's done at large volume centers, it is worth noting that the centers participating in this study were large volume centers. Again, if not treated with RPLND, all of these men would have gotten chemo or radiation. The relapse rate after radiation therapy or chemotherapy is about 5%. So the relapse risk is higher after surgery, but in a sense, if we take 100 men with early stage 2 seminoma and do an RPLND instead of chemo or radiation, we can spare 80% of them the long-term effects of chemotherapy or radiation. Alternatively, if the priority is simply to prevent a relapse, radiation therapy and chemotherapy are more effective at that, the relapse risk being only about 5%, but at the cost of long-term side effects from chemotherapy or radiation potentially. So the bottom line is there is an additional treatment option for low-volume stage 2 seminoma for men who prioritize avoiding the complications of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, both of which are associated with an increased risk of death from other causes. But the price we pay for that is the relapse risk is a little bit higher with RPLND compared to the other approaches. Not all centers are going to be offering this, but major centers that do a lot of testicular cancer, this is becoming a new treatment option, with the caveat that we have less experience with this approach. This is a relatively small study, and we have a lot more experience with chemo or radiation. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all here, but I think patients should talk about with their doctor if they have early-stage seminoma, they should talk about surgery as an alternative to radiation or chemo.
All right, here we go. Surveillance after complete response in patients with metastatic non-seminomatous. Ooh,
seminomatous. Non-seminomatous germ cell
yes.
tumor.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gilligan. Germ cell tumor.
So this study is looking at the question of if you take a man who has retroperitoneal lymph nodes that are enlarged, and so metastatic non-seminomatous testis cancer with lymphadenopathy in the back of the abdomen, and you put them through chemotherapy, and at the end of chemotherapy, all of the retroperitoneal nodes are now within what we call normal limits, normal size nodes, which means no bigger than 10 millimeters or 1 centimeter. And do we need to do a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection on those patients? Some centers recommend RPLND for those patients and some don't. This study looked at 388 men in that situation, and they were just put on surveillance. So these men did not undergo the post-chemo RPLND. Two-year survival, overall survival was 97.8%. Two-year progression-free survival was 90%. 34 patients relapsed, and 10 of those men died. Men who did relapse had surgery, chemotherapy, or both as subsequent treatment. There's a prior similar study that was multi-center that had longer follow-up of 5 years, and they reported that of 161 men who had a complete response to first-line chemo, 10 relapsed, so 6%, and none died. So if we combine these two studies together, the bottom line is you would have to perform a post-chemotherapy retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, which is a big operation, on about 550 men to prevent potentially at most 44 relapses and 10 deaths. We don't even know if we would prevent or how many of those relapses and deaths we would prevent, but it's a lot of operations with a relatively low yield. In the future, we hope to have blood tests that will tell us which men need surgery. And even right now, we're close to the point that we have blood tests that will detect residual cancer. The challenge is we worry about residual teratoma in these patients too, and we don't have blood tests on the horizon that pick up teratoma. But the bottom line again here is that in the meantime, the preferred management strategy is surveillance rather than surgery for most men. There's some men for whom RPLND may make sense in this center, in this setting, and there's some centers that will probably continue to recommend it for most men. But I think this data really casts doubt on whether we ought to be doing this operation in these men as a routine practice as opposed to an exceptional practice for men who have particular characteristics. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gilligan. And now we can move on to answering some questions. Was the average time expected to see a decline in PSA in patients treated with lutetium-177 PSMA?
This is a great question. I think we are waiting for the manuscript to be published to go through the nuances of those data. Right now, what Dr. Michael Morris from Memorial Sloan Kettering presented were the high-level data on radiographic progression-free survival and overall survival and some other secondary endpoints. So we are anxiously waiting the full data in the form of a manuscript. And until then, I will not be able to answer that question. I would like to add that usually the median time, if you look at how long patients were receiving lutetium, it was 5 to 6 months, if my recollection is correct.
Is radiation required prior to initiating chemo if there's tumor presence? And Dr. Gilligan, you responded, we only rarely use radiation therapy for testicular cancer at this time. Sometimes it is used for stage 1 or stage 2 seminoma as primary treatment instead of chemotherapy. And I'll just read these aloud for our viewers here. If a patient has both prostate and bladder cancer, how do you decide which therapy should take priority? Also, is the CPS typically included on the biopsy report? And Dr. Grievous, you responded, which I'll read here. This is a bit complicated scenario that requires detailed discussion with a urologist and medical oncologist. Regarding CPS, the possible role is only in the first line setting of metastatic disease to help somewhat decide between chemotherapy followed by avelumab maintenance and immunotherapy. However, it is not a perfect biomarker. It is not part of the pathology report. It's a special test that requires specific ordering. I have a question for you, Dr. Zhang. Why do combination treatments seem to work better in kidney cancer? Wouldn't you have more side effects because you're taking two drugs at the same time?
Oh, it's an interesting question. You know, our immunotherapy backbones seem to have good treatment benefit for these immune responsive disease. The VEGF inhibitors that have blocked blood vessel formation for many of our patients with clear cell kidney cancer, they tend to have an immune modulatory role. So if we normalize blood vessels in the tumor microenvironment, the thought is that the T cells, the immune cells, can actually get into that space more readily. And so many of these blood vessel blockers are hypothesized to have increased immune modulatory types of behaviors. And so the combination actually can be more effective than either agent alone. And we've certainly seen that in practice, and really excited to see these combination strategies thrive and be standard of care for our patients now in first line treatment. For the side effect question, you know, I do think that sometimes you do have to tease out which of the side effects is related to the oral treatment, the blood vessel blocker versus the immune therapy. But it's often experienced oncologists who are able to manage these side effects. We can try to tailor and see which of the side effects is due to what treatment and how to dose reduce or hold treatments when necessary.
Great. I just got a follow-up question for you, Dr. Zhang. Are there any studies for papillary type kidney cancer with sarcoma?
I would assume you're asking about sarcomatoid renal cell carcinoma within papillary. So for papillary type of kidney cancers, there are ongoing studies, for example, with FH mutations and FH loss. For sarcomatoid disease, this is a special type of histology that can occur with any of our actual histologies of kidney cancer. And we know from our phase 3 trials in clear cell sarcomatoid renal cells that these tend to respond to the immunotherapy combinations. And so I would urge using an immune therapy combination in patients who had sarcomatoid renal cell carcinoma.
Dr. Agarwal, here's a question for you. There were several studies this year that showed many patients did not receive combination ADT with other novel therapies, which you described as the standard of care, including the one you discussed. Is this something that patients should proactively bring up with their doctors?
Fantastic question. I'm so glad you asked this. Answer is yes. It is our responsibility as physicians and providers, but it doesn't hurt if our patients are educated and challenge us in our decision-making. It is a shared decision-making. It is not doctor's decision. In my view, it's patient's decision with help from the doctors. So yes, please go do it. Doctors usually welcome that.
Great.
I see one for Dr. Gilligan about surveillance imaging that just popped up.
Yeah, they're asking whether there's data on benefits versus risks for imaging-based surveillance. It's actually a very timely question in the sense that we're starting to get data that MRI is very accurate for this and will likely become a substitute for CT scans at some point in the future. This is something we talk about a lot in terms of surveillance for testis cancer patients. Can we switch from CT to MRI? Because CT has ionizing radiation that can cause other cancers potentially. MRI does not. So right now, the good news is it really looks like with current CT scanning, which is lower dose than older CT scanning, the risk of cancer from the CT scan seems really minuscule. Ultimately, it would be great to get it down to zero and not do them, but we're still doing them. The switch to MRI is being held up by the fact that when you go in and get an imaging study for surveillance, your scans get looked at by a radiologist and also by the oncologist. And all of us who do a lot of testicular cancer have multiple stories of catching stuff that the radiologist missed. And they also catch stuff that we miss. It goes both directions, but having two different people read the films gets a more accurate read. With MRI, most oncologists are not competent to read an MRI well, and some radiologists are not great at it. So the centers where they really have excellence have shown that the MRIs are just as good as CT scans if they're read by fully qualified people. The concern right now is, are we confident that they're going to be skillfully read or not? So I think the switch to MRI will happen in the future, but I have spoken with people very recently about this who are practicing around the country, and the people I talk to are not ready to make that switch yet because of that concern that stuff might get missed. And again, I think we can be reassured that with the modern lower dose CT scans, the risk seems to be quite small. And I look forward in the future to making that switch at some point.
And I think that's going to be our last question this afternoon. Thank you to all of our participants for sharing this great research with us, as well as your expertise. It's been a real pleasure on this live webinar here.
Thank you, Dr. Agarwal, Dr. Grievous, Dr. Zhang, and Dr. Gilligan. You can find more research from recent scientific meetings at www.cancer.net. And if this podcast was useful, please take a minute to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. This Cancer.net podcast is part of the ASCO Podcast Network. This collection of 9 programs offers insight into the world of cancer care, covering a range of educational, inspirational, and scientific content. You can find all 9 shows, including this one, at podcast.asco.org. Cancer.net is supported by Conquer Cancer, the ASCO Foundation, which funds breakthrough research for every type of cancer, helping patients everywhere. To help fund Cancer.net and programs like it, donate at conquer.org/donate.